Dr. Undershaft, the chorus master, peered at Agnes over the top of his half-moon spectacles.
"The, departure aria, as it is known," he said, "is quite a little masterpiece. Not one of the great operatic highlights, but very memorable nevertheless."
His eyes misted over.
"Questa maledetta," sings Iodine as she tells Peccadillo how hard it is for her to leave him. "Questa maledetta porta si blocca, si blocca comunque diavolo lo faccio."
He stopped and made great play of cleaning his glasses with his handkerchief.
"When Gigli sang it, there wasn't a dry eye in the house," he mumbled. "I was there. It was then that I decided that I would... Oh, great days indeed."
He put his glasses on and blew his nose.
"I'll run through it once," he said, "just so that you can understand how it is supposed to go. Very well, André?"
The young man who had been drafted in to play the piano in the rehearsal room nodded and winked surreptitiously at Agnes. She pretended not to have seen him, and listened with an expression of acute studiousness as the old man worked his way through the score.
"And now," he said, "let us see how you manage."
He handed her the score and nodded at the pianist. Agnes sang the aria, or at least a few bars of it. André stopped playing and leaned his head against the piano, trying to stifle a laugh.
"Ahem," said Undershaft.
"Was I doing something wrong?"
"You were singing tenor," said Undershaft, looking sternly at André.
"She was singing in your voice, sir."
"Perhaps you can sing it like, Christine would sing it?"
They started again.
"Questa maledetta."
Undershaft held up both hands. André's shoulders were shaking with the effort of not laughing.
"Yes, yes, accurately observed. I dare say you're right. But could we start again, and perhaps you could sing it how you think it should be sung?"
Agnes nodded. They started again, and finished. Undershaft had sat down, half turned away. He wouldn't look round to face her. Agnes stood, watching him uncertainly.
Was that all right?" she said.
André, the pianist, got up slowly and took her hand. "I think we'd better leave him," he said softly, pulling her towards the door.
"Was it that bad?"
"Not exactly." Undershaft raised his head, but didn't turn it towards her.
"More practice on those R's, madam, and strive for greater security above the stave," he said hoarsely.
"Yes, yes, I will." André led her out into the corridor, shut the door, and then turned to her. "That was astounding," he said. "Did you ever hear the great Gigli sing?"
"I don't even know who Gigli is. What was I singing?"
"You didn't know that either?"
"I don't know what it means, no."
André looked down at the score in his hand. "Well, I'm not much good at the language, but I suppose the opening could be sung something like this. This damn door sticks, this damn door sticks, it sticks no matter what the hell I do. It's marked pull, and indeed I am pulling, perhaps it should be marked push."
Agnes blinked. "Well, that's it?"
"Yes,
but I thought it was supposed to be very moving and romantic."
"It is," said André. "It was. This isn't real life, this is opera. It doesn't matter what the words mean, it's the feeling that matters. Hasn't anyone told... Look, I'm in rehearsals for the rest of the afternoon, but perhaps we could meet tomorrow, perhaps after breakfast?"
"Oh, no," thought Agnes. "Here it comes."
The blush was moving inexorably upwards. She wondered if one day it might reach her face and carry on going, so that it ended up as a big pink cloud over her head.
Yes, she said. "Yes, that would be very helpful.
Now I've got to go." He gave her a weak little smile and patted her hand. "And I'm really sorry it's happening this way, because that was astounding." He went to walk away and then stopped. Sorry if I frightened you last night," he said.
"What?"
"On the stairs."
"Oh, that. I wasn't frightened."
"You, didn't mention it to anyone, did you? I'd hate people to think I was worrying over nothing." "I hadn't given it another thought, to tell you the truth. I know you can't be the ghost if that's what you're worried about, eh?"
"Me? The ghost? Ha ha!
Ha ha," said Agnes. "So, see you tomorrow, then?"
"Fine."
Agnes headed back to her room, deep in thought. Christine was there, looking critically at herself in the mirror. She spun around as Agnes entered. She even moved with exclamation marks.
Oh, Perdita, have you heard? I'm to sing the part of Iodine tonight. Isn't that wonderful?
She dashed across the room and endeavoured to pick Agnes up and hug her, settling eventually for just hugging her.
And I heard they're already letting you in the chorus.
Yes, indeed.
Isn't that nice? I've been practising all morning with Mr. Salzella. Questa maledetta porter si blocker.
She twirled happily. Invisible sequins filled the air with their shine.
When I'm very famous, she said, you won't regret having a friend in me. I shall do my very best to help you. I'm sure you bring me luck.
Yes, indeed, said Agnes, hopelessly.
Because my dear father told me that one day a dear little pixie would arrive to help me achieve my great ambition, and you know, I think that little pixie is you.
Agnes smiled unhappily. After you'd known Christine for any length of time, you found yourself fighting a desire to look into her ear to see if you could spot daylight coming out the other way.
I thought we had swapped rooms.
Oh, that, said Christine, smiling. Wasn't I silly? Anyway, I shall need the big mirror now that I am to be a prima donna. You don't mind, do you?
What? Oh, no, of course not. If you're sure.
Agnes looked at the mirror and then at the bed and then at Christine.
No, she said, shocked at the enormity of the idea that had just presented itself, delivered from the Perdita of her soul. I'm sure that will be fine.
Dr. Undershaft blew his nose and tried to tidy himself up. Well, he didn't have to stand for it. Perhaps the child was somewhat on the heavy side, but Jeegley, for example, had once crushed a tenor to death, and no one had thought any worse of her for it. He'd protest to Mr. Bucket. Dr. Undershaft was a single-minded man. He believed in voices. It didn't matter what anyone looked like. He never watched opera with his eyes open. It was the music that mattered, not the acting, and certainly not the shape of the singers. What did it matter what shape she was? Dame Tessitura had a beard you could strike a match on, and a nose flattened half across her face, but she was still one of the best basses who ever opened beer bottles with her thumb. Of course, Salzella said that while everyone accepted that large women of 50 could play thin girls of 17, people wouldn't accept that a fat girl of 17 could do it. He said they'd cheerfully swallow a big lie and choke on a little fib. Salzella said that sort of thing. Something was going wrong these days. The whole place seemed sick, if a building could be sick. The crowds were still coming, but the money just didn't seem to be there anymore. Everything seemed to be so expensive, and now they were owned by a cheesemonger, for heaven's sake. Some grubby counter-jumper who'd probably want to bring in fancy ideas. What they needed was a businessman, some clerk who could add up columns of figures properly and not interfere. That was the trouble with all the owners he had experienced. They started off thinking of themselves as businessmen, and then suddenly began to think they could make an artistic contribution. Still, possibly cheesemongers had to add up cheeses. Just so long as this one stayed in his office with the books, and didn't go around acting as though he owned the place just because he happened to own the place. Undershaft blinked. He'd gone the wrong way again. No matter how long you'd been here, this place was a maze. He was behind the stage in the orchestra's room. Instruments and folding chairs had been stacked everywhere. His foot toppled a beer bottle. The twang of a string made him look around. Broken instruments littered the floor. There were half a dozen smashed violins. Several oboes had been broken. The trom had been pulled right out of a trombone. He looked up into someone's face.
But why are you...
The half-moon's spectacles tumbled over and over and smashed on the boards. Then the attacker lowered his mask, as smooth and white as the skull of an angel, and stepped forward purposefully. Dr. Undershaft blinked. There was a darkness. A cloaked figure raised its head and looked at him through bony white sockets. Dr. Undershaft's recent memories were a little confused, but one fact stood out.
Ah, he said. Got you! You're the ghost!
You know, you're rather amusingly wrong.
Dr. Undershaft watched another masked figure pick up the body of Dr. Undershaft and drag it into the shadows.
Oh, I see. I'm dead.
Death nodded.
Such would appear to be the case.
That was murder. Does anyone know?
The murderer. And you, of course.
But him, How can...
Undershaft began.
We must go, said Death.
But he just killed me. Strangled me with his bare hands.
Yes. Chalk it up to experience.
You mean I can't do anything about it?
Leave it to the living. Generally speaking, they get uneasy when the deceased takes a constructive role in a murder investigation. They tend to lose concentration.
You know, you do have a very good bass voice.
Thank you.
Are there going to be choirs and things?
Would you like some?
Agnes slipped out through the stage door and into the streets of Ankh-Morpork. She blinked in the light. The air felt slightly prickly and sharp and too cold. What she was about to do was wrong, very wrong, and all her life she'd done things that were right. Go on, said Perdita. In fact, she probably wouldn't even do it, but there was no harm in just asking where there was a herbal shop. So she asked. And there was no harm in going in. So she went in, and it certainly wasn't against any kind of law to buy the ingredients she bought. After all, she might get a headache later on or be unable to sleep. And it would mean nothing at all to take them back to her room and tuck them under the mattress. That's right, said Perdita. In fact, if you averaged out the moral difficulty of what she was proposing over all the little activities she had to undergo in order to do it, it probably wasn't that bad at all, really. These comforting thoughts were arranging themselves in her mind as she headed back. She turned a corner and nearly walked into Nanny Ogg and Granny Weatherwax. She flung herself against the wall and stopped breathing. They hadn't seen her, although Nanny's foul cat leered at her over its owner's shoulder. They'd take her back. She just knew they would. The fact that she was a free agent and her own mistress and quite at liberty to go off to Ankh-Morpork had nothing to do with it. They'd interfere. They always did. She scurried back along the alley and ran as fast as she could to the rear of the opera house. The stage doorkeeper took no notice of her. Granny and Nanny strolled through the city towards the area known as the Isle of Gods. It wasn't exactly Ankh, and it wasn't exactly Morpork, being situated where the river bent so much it almost formed an island. It was where the city kept all those things it occasionally needed but was uneasy about, like the watch house, the theatres, the prison, and the publishers. It was the place for all those things which might go off bang in unexpected ways. Grebo ambled along behind them. The air was full of new smells, and he was looking forward to seeing if any of them belonged to anything he could eat, fight, or ravish. Nanny Ogg found herself getting increasingly worried.
"This isn't really us, Esme," she said.
"Who is it, then?"
"I mean, the book was just a bit of fun. No sense in making ourselves unpopular, is there?"
"Can't have witches being done down, Githa."
"I don't feel done down. I felt fine until you told me I was done down," said Nanny, putting her finger on a major sociological point.
"You've been exploited," said Granny firmly.
"No, I ain't."
"Yes, you have. You're a downtrodden mass."
"No, I ain't."
"You've been swindled out of your life savings," said Granny.
$2?
"Well, it's all you'd actually saved," said Granny accurately.
"Only 'cause I spent everything else," said Nanny.
Other people salted away money for their old age, but Nanny preferred to accumulate memories.
"Well, there you are, then."
"I was putting that by for some new piping for my still up at Copperhead," said Nanny. "You know how that scumble eats away at the metal."
Distillation of alcohol was illegal in Lancre. On the other hand, King Verence had long ago given up any idea of stopping a witch doing something she wanted to do, so merely required Nanny Ogg to keep her still somewhere it wasn't obvious. She thoroughly approved of the prohibition, since this gave her an unchallenged market for her own product, known wherever men fell backwards into a ditch, as Suicider.
"You were putting a little something by for some security and peace of mind in your old age," Granny translated.
"You don't get peace of mind with my scumble," said Nanny happily. "Pieces, yes, but not peace. It's made from the finest apples, you know," she added. "Well, mainly apples."
Granny stopped outside an ornate doorway and peered at the brass plate affixed thereon.
"This is the place," she said.
They looked at the door.
"I've never been one for front doors," said Nanny, shifting from one foot to the other.
Granny nodded. Witches had a thing about front doors. A brief search located an alleyway which led around the back of the building. Here was a pair of much larger doors, wide open. Several dwarfs were loading bundles of books onto a cart. A rhythmic thumping came from somewhere beyond the doorway. No one took any notice of the witches as they wandered inside. Movable type was known in Ankh-Morpork, but if wizards heard about it, they moved it where no one could find it. They generally didn't interfere with the running of the city, but when it came to movable type, the pointy foot was put down hard. They had never explained why, and people didn't press the issue because you didn't press the issue with wizards, not if you liked yourself the shape you were. They simply worked around the problem and engraved everything. This took a long time, and meant that Ankh-Morpork was, for example, denied the benefit of newspapers, leaving the population to fool themselves as best they could. A press was thumping gently at one end of the warehouse. Beside it, at long tables, a number of dwarfs and humans were stitching pages together and gluing on the covers. Nanny took a book off a pile. It was The Joy of Snacks.
"Can I help you, ladies?" said a voice. Its tone suggested very clearly that it wasn't anticipating offering any kind of help whatsoever, except out into the street at speed.
"We've come about this book," said Granny.
"I'm Mrs. Ogg," said Nanny Ogg.
The man looked her up and down.
"Oh, yes. Can you identify yourself?"
"Certainly. I'd know me anywhere."
"Ha! Well, I happen to know what Githa Ogg looks like, madam, and she does not look like you."
Nanny Ogg opened her mouth to reply, and then said in the voice of one who has stepped happily into the road and only now remembers about the onrushing coach,
"Oh!"
"And how do you know what Mrs. Ogg looks like?" said Granny.
"Oh, is that the time? We'd better be going," said Nanny.
"Because, as a matter of fact, she sent me a picture,"
said Goatburger, taking out his wallet.
"I'm sure we're not at all interested," said Nanny, hurriedly pulling on Granny's arm.
"I'm extremely interested," said Granny.
She snatched a folded piece of paper out of Goatburger's hands and peered at it.
"Eh? Yes, that's Githa Ogg, all right,"
she said.
"Yes, indeed, I remember when that young artist came to Lankra for the summer."
"I wore my hair longer in those days," muttered Nanny.
"Just as well, considering," said Granny. "I didn't know you had copies, though."
"Oh, you know how it is when you're young," said Nanny dreamily. "It was doodle, doodle, doodle all summer long."
She awoke from her reverie. "And I still weigh the same now as I did then," she added.
"Except that it's shifted," said Granny nastily.
She handed the sketch back to Goatburger.
"That's her, all right," she said, "but it's out by about 60 years and several layers of clothing. This is Githa Ogg right here."
"You're telling me this came up with banana nana soup surprise?"
"Did you try it?" said Nanny.
"Mr. Cropper, the head printer, did, yes."
"Was he surprised?"
"Not half as surprised as Mrs. Cropper."
"It can take people like that," said Nanny. "I think perhaps I overdo the nutmeg."
Goatburger stared at her. Doubt was beginning to assail him. You only had to look at Nanny Ogg grinning back at you to believe she could write something like The Joy of Snacks.
"Did you really write this?" he said.
"From memory," said Nanny proudly.
"And now she'd like some money," said Granny.
Mr. Goatburger's face twisted up as though he'd just eaten a lemon and washed it down with vinegar.
"But we gave her the money back," he said.
"See?" said Nanny, her face falling. "I told you, Esme."
"She wants some more," said Granny.
"No, I don't."
"No, she doesn't," Goatburger agreed.
"She does," said Granny. "She wants a little bit of money for every book you've sold."
"I don't expect to be treated like royalty," said Nanny.
"Strictly speaking, this means being chased by photographers anxious to get a picture of you with your vest off."
"You shut up," said Granny. "I know what you want. We want some money, Mr. Goatburger."
"And what if I won't give it to you?"
Granny glared at him.
"Then we shall go away and think about what to do next," she said.
"That's no idle threat," said Nanny. "There's a lot of people have regretted Esme thinking about what to do next."
"Come back when you've thought, then,"
snapped Goatburger. He stormed off.
"I don't know. Authors wanting to be paid. Good grief."
He disappeared among the stacks of books.
"Do you think that could have gone better?" said Nanny.
Granny glanced at the table beside them. It was stacked with long sheets of paper. She nudged a dwarf, who had been watching the argument with some amusement.
"What are these?"
she said.
They're proofs for the almanac.
He saw her blank expression.
They're sort of a trial run for the book, so's we can check that all the spelling mistakes have been left in.
Granny picked it up.
Come, Githa, she said.
I don't want trouble, Esme, said Nanny Og as she hurried after her. It's only money.
It ain't money any more, said Granny. It's a way of keeping score.
Mr. Bucket picked up a violin. It was in two pieces, held together by the strings. One of them broke.
Who'd do something like this? He said. Honestly, Salzella, what is the difference between opera and madness?
Is this a trick question?
No.
Then I'd say better scenery. Ah, I thought so.
Salzella rooted among the destruction and stood up with a letter in his hand.
Would you like me to open it? He said. It's addressed to you.
Bucket shut his eyes.
Go on, he said. Don't bother about the details. Just tell me how many exclamation marks.
5.
Oh.
Salzella passed the paper over. Bucket read. Dear Bucket, whoops. Ha 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 ha. Yours, the Opera Ghost.
What can we do? He said. One moment he writes polite little notes, the next he goes mad on paper.
Herr Trubelmacher has got everyone out hunting for new instruments, said Salzella.
Are violins more expensive than ballet shoes?
There are few things in the world more expensive than ballet shoes. Violins happen to be among them, said Salzella.
Oh, further expense?
It seems so, yes.
But I thought the ghost liked music.
Herr Trubelmacher tells me the organ is beyond repair.
He stopped. He was aware that he had exclaimed a little less rationally than a sane man should.
Oh, well, Bucket continued wearily, the show must go on, I suppose.
Yes, indeed, said Salzella.
Bucket shook his head.
How's it all going for tonight?
I think it will work, if that's what you mean. Perdita seems to have a very good grasp of the part.
And Christine?
She has an astonishingly good grasp of wearing a dress. Between them, they make one prima donna.
The proud owner of the opera house got slowly to his feet.
It all seems so simple, he moaned.
I thought, opera, how hard can it be? Songs, pretty girls dancing, nice scenery, lots of people handing over cash. Got to be better than the cutthroat world of yoghurt, I thought.
Now, everywhere I go, there's...
Something crunched under his shoe. He picked up the remains of a pair of half-moon spectacles.
These are Dr. Undershaft's, aren't they? He said. What are they doing here?
His eyes met Salzella's steady gaze.
Oh, no, he groaned.
Salzella turned slightly and stared hard at a big double bass case leaning against the wall. He raised his eyebrows.
Oh, no, said Bucket again. Go on, open it. My hands have gone all sweaty.
Salzella padded across to the case and grasped the lid.
Ready?
Bucket nodded wearily. The case was flung open.
Oh, no.
Salzella craned round to see.
Ah, yes, he said. A broken neck, and the body has been kicked in considerably. That'll cost a dollar or two to repair, and no mistake.
All the strings are busted. Are double basses more expensive to rebuild than violins?
I am afraid that all musical instruments are incredibly expensive to repair, with the possible exception of the triangle, said Salzella. However, could have been worse, hmm?
What?
Well, it could have been Dr. Undershaft in there, yes?
Bucket gaped at him, and then shut his mouth.
Oh, yes, yes, of course, oh, yes, that would have been worse. Yes, bit of luck there, I suppose, yes, hmm?
So that's an opera house, is it? Said Granny. Looks like someone built a great big box and glued the architecture on afterwards.
She coughed and appeared to be waiting for something.
Can we have a look around? Said Nanny dutifully,
aware that Granny's curiosity was equalled only by her desire not to show it.
It can't do any harm, I suppose, said Granny, as if granting a big favour. Seeing as we've nothing else to do right this minute.
The opera house was indeed that most efficiently multifunctional of building designs. It was a cube. But as Granny had pointed out, the architect had suddenly realised late in the day that there ought to be some sort of decoration, and had shoved it on hurriedly in a riot of friezes, pillars, corybants and curly bits. Gargoyles had colonised the higher reaches. The effect, seen from the front, was of a huge wall of tortured stone. Round the back, of course, there was the usual drab mess of windows, pipes, and damp stone walls. One of the rules of a certain type of public architecture is that it only happens at the front. Granny paused under a window.
"Someone's singing," she said. "Listen."
"La la la la," trilled someone. "Do re mi fa sol la ti do."
"That's opera, right enough," said Granny.
"Sounds foreign to me."
Nanny had an unexpected gift for languages. She could be comprehensibly incompetent in a new one within an hour or two. What she spoke was one step away from gibberish, but it was authentically foreign gibberish. And she knew that Granny Weatherwax, whatever her other qualities, had an even bigger tin ear for languages than she did for music.
Could be," she said. "There's always a lot going on, I know that. Our Nev said they sometimes do different operations every night."
"How did he find that out?"
said Granny.
"Well, there was a lot of lead. That takes some shifting. He said he liked the noisy ones. He could hum along, and also no one heard the hammering."
The witches strolled onwards.
"Did you notice young Agnes nearly bump into us back there?" said Granny.
"Yes, it was all I could do not to turn around," said Nanny.
"She wasn't very pleased to see us, was she? I practically heard her gasp."
"That's very suspicious, if you ask me," said Nanny. "I mean, she sees two friendly faces from back home. You'd expect her to come running up."
"We're old friends, after all. Old friends of her grandma and her mum, anyway. And that's practically the same."
"Remember those eyes in the teacup?" said Nanny. "She could be under the gaze of some strange occult force. We got to be careful. People can be very tricky when they're in the grip of a strange occult force. Remember Mr. Scruple over in Slice?"
"That wasn't a strange occult force. That was acid stomach."
"Well, it certainly seemed strangely occult for a while, especially if the windows were shut."
The perambulation had taken them to the opera house's stage door. Granny looked up at the line of posters.
"La Triviata," she read aloud. "The Ring of the Nibelunging-Gung."
"Well, basically, there are two sorts of opera," said Nanny, who also had the true witch's ability to be confidently expert on the basis of no experience whatsoever. "There's your heavy opera, where basically people sing foreign and it goes like, 'Oh, I am dying, oh, I'm dying, oh, that's what I'm doing.' And there's your light opera, where they sing in foreign and it basically goes, 'Beer, beer, beer, I like to drink lots of beer,' although sometimes they drink champagne instead. That's basically all of opera, really."
"What? Either dying or drinking beer?"
"Basically, yes," said Nanny, contriving to suggest that this was the whole gamut of human experience.
"And that's opera?"
"Well, there might be some other stuff, but mostly it's stout or stabbing."
Granny was aware of a presence. She turned. A figure had emerged from the stage door, carrying a poster, a bucket of glue and a brush. It was a strange figure, a sort of neat scarecrow, in clothes slightly too small for it, although, to be truthful, there were probably no clothes that would have fit that body. The ankles and wrists seemed infinitely extensible and independently guided. It encountered the two witches standing at the poster board and stopped politely. They could see the sentence marshalling itself behind the unfocused eyes.
"Excuse me, ladies, the show must go on."
The words were all there, and they made sense, but each sentence was fired out into the world as a unit. Granny pulled Nanny to one side.
"Thank you."
They watched in silence as the man, with great and meticulous care, applied paste to a neat rectangle and then affixed the poster, smoothing every crease methodically.
"What's your name, young man?" said Granny.
"Walter."
"That's a nice beret you have there."
"My mum bought it for me."
Walter chased the last air bubble to the edge of the paper and stood back. Then, completely ignoring the witches in his preoccupation with his task, he picked up the paste pot and went back inside. The witches stared at the new poster in silence.
"You know, I wouldn't mind seeing an operation," said Nanny after a while. "Signor Basilica did give us the tickets."
"Oh, you know me," said Granny. "Can't be having with that sort of thing at all."
Nanny looked sideways at her and grinned to herself. This was a familiar Weatherwax opening line. It meant, "Of course I want to, but you've got to persuade me."
"You're right, of course," she said. "It's for them folks in all their fine carriages. It's not for the likes of us."
Granny looked hesitant for a moment.
"I expect it's having ideas above our station," Nanny went on. "I expect if we went in they'd say, 'Be off, you nasty old crones.'"
"Oh, they would they?"
"I don't expect they want common folk, like what we are, coming in with all those smart, knobby people," said Nanny.
"Is that a fact? Is that a fact, madam? You just come with me."
Granny stalked round to the front of the building, where people were already alighting from coaches. She pushed her way up the steps and shouldered through the crowd to the ticket office. She leaned forward. The man behind the grill leaned back.
"Nasty old crones, eh?" she snapped.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Not before time. See here, we've got tickets for,
She looked down at the pieces of cardboard and pulled Nanny Ogg over.
"It says here, stalls. The cheek of it. Stalls? Us?"
She turned back to the ticket man.
"See here, stalls aren't good enough. We want seats in..."
She looked up at the board by the ticket window.
"The gods. Yes, that sounds about right."
"I'm sorry? You've got tickets for stall seats and you want to exchange them for seats in the gods?"
"Yes, and don't you go expecting us to pay any more money."
I wasn't going to ask you for..."
"Just as well," said Granny, smiling triumphantly.
She looked approvingly at the new tickets.
"Come, Githa."
Excuse me, said the man, as Nanny Ogg turned away, "but what is that on your shoulders?"
"It's a fur collar," said Nanny.
"Excuse me, but I just saw it flick its tail."
"Yes, I happen to believe in beauty without cruelty."